You write that even the most despised person, perhaps especially the most despised, has the right to a vigorous defense. Is that true even for an enemy of the state in a post 9/11 world?
Yes, I believe it is. I think we have to be careful not to accept the government's label that someone is an enemy of the state. That remains to be proven. And if we don't have people step up to challenge that assertion, then we run the risk of detaining people unjustly indefinitely, long periods of time, as I believe we have done with many of these Guantanamo detainees.
You also write that you agree to represent them because of your conviction that if lawyers do not step forward to challenge government overreaching, who will? My question is, shouldn't all citizens step forward, not only lawyers, to challenge government overreaching?
Well, yes, I believe they should. I think citizens should speak out when they perceive government overreaching. I do think that lawyers are uniquely positioned, though, to bring legal challenges to government overreaching, and that's why I say that it especially falls to lawyers, and traditionally has fallen to lawyers, to hold the government accountable to its standards, to its ideals.
You volunteered your services in 2007, and you write that a careful examination of the evidence will puncture the exaggerated and hysterical claims of politicians and pundits. Could you explain that, please?
Yes, I think what I was referring to when I said that are the claims that we hear today from, for example, Senator John McCain, who says that these five men that were recently transferred in exchange for Sergeant Bergdahl were terrorists with the blood of Americans on their hands. That is an absolute falsehood with respect to my client. And I think one has to examine the evidence that the government has on each one of these men and determine if those assertions are true. And I think if one examines the evidence, it punctures those claims. They're bags of wind, and they cannot withstand an analysis of the facts. And John McCain should know better.
Are you saying your client is innocent? And I'll remind you that most attorneys claim their clients are innocent.
Well, sure. The question in the case of the Guantanamo detainees is innocent of what? My client has never, in over a dozen years of captivity, been accused of even a misdemeanor. He's never been accused of any crime whatsoever. He's not been accused of a violation of the law of war. He's never been accused of having the blood of Americans on his hands. And so, yes, I say he is innocent of any such assertion. Now, he, my particular client, this last one at least, was a member of the Taliban. There's no question about that. He was a high-ranking political official in the administration of the government of his country during the time that the Taliban formed that government. But he was not a military man. He was not on the battlefield. He was never picked up on the battlefield. He had no role whatsoever in fighting against America and its allies.
What additional information can you give us about your client?
Well, first of all, I'm constrained in responding to that question because in order to represent my client, in order to represent any of the other clients I've had in Guantanamo, the attorneys were all required to sign a protective order. And what that means is that in exchange for access to the classified information that would enable us to see the evidence and defend our clients, we had to sign away our free speech. We cannot comment on anything that we've seen that's classified. We had to get background checks and get security clearances. I have a top secret security clearance in order to be able to access that information. So when people like Senator McCain or anyone else makes an accusation, we are really powerless to respond with detailed evidence that's been developed about our client. Now, having said that, I can tell you about the unclassified evidence that was developed about him. And it is really undisputed that he was viewed by the Afghan government, the current Afghan government, and by other people in the U.S. government as being a very moderate member of the Taliban. Despite his affiliation with that administration, he was viewed as somebody skilled in mediating between conflicting groups. And so in 2011, the Karzai government, through its High Peace Council, formally wrote a letter asking that he be returned to Afghanistan to assist in the peace process.
Was your client captured by American forces?
No, he was not. In fact, it's a common myth that American forces captured most of the 779 men who have been detained in Guantanamo. In fact, American forces captured probably 5% of them. My client, this particular client, was arrested in Pakistan by Pakistani authorities. He was visiting in the home of an acquaintance in Pakistan, and the Pakistani police raided the home in search of the other man, not my client. The other man fled. My client remained, and because of his political prominence, they arrested him.
What about the four other men that were traded for Sergeant Bergdahl?
You know, I really don't know much about them, and that's because the classification process allowed me information, access to information only about my client. And so I don't have that kind of information about the other men.
You also wrote that of the nearly 780 men from 43 countries that were transported to Guantanamo, the Bush administration decided to release hundreds. Was that, in your opinion, underreported? And where did these men go?
Well, two questions. So I think, yes, it was definitely underreported. The Bush administration, of the common figure is 779 men who passed through Guantanamo. President Bush released 532 of them quietly, without any fanfare. He released, for example, a man named Abdullah Tabarak, who was Osama bin Laden's chief bodyguard and longtime confidant, a man who had turned himself in to allow Osama bin Laden to escape. And to the astonishment of military investigators who went to Guantanamo Bay in 2003 to interview him, they found that he was not there, and nobody would tell them why. And it turns out he was sent to Morocco by President Bush very quietly without any fanfare. There were other men equally potentially dangerous associated with al-Qaeda whom Bush released. There were two men from Britain, and in order apparently to maintain good relations with Tony Blair, these two men were sent to Britain in 2005. There were a huge number of people that President Bush released, and we did not hear any outcry whatsoever by the Republicans or by anybody else at that time that it was an outrage to release these men from Guantanamo. So why these five men after a dozen years of detention and no charges having been brought against them? I think it is political theater. Now, as to where they were sent, most of the men who were released were sent back to their home countries. There are some men from Yemen who were sent to Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia had a so-called rehabilitation program, and they would go through that program and then presumably be returned to Yemen.
You served in the U.S. Army, received a commission as an infantry lieutenant in 1967, and served as a captain in the U.S. Army Judge Advocate General Corps, General's Corps. How has your military experience influenced your career as an attorney and your decision to go to Guantanamo?
You know, I think it did it in a couple of ways. One is that part of my duty when I was a JAG officer in the Army during the Vietnam era was to, actually I had to lecture Army commanders and their troops on the laws of war. And so I was very interested in the international law of war. I found it surprising and appalling that we were detaining men indefinitely without any charges being brought against them in Guantanamo, and that prompted me to try to right what I saw as a wrong, and I wanted to volunteer to assist in that effort. The other thing, the other part of my military experience that I think is illuminating to me is my confidence in the court-martial system. I believe it's a fair system. I can't say that about military commissions. I don't have any experience with them. But the Army court-martial system under the Uniform Code of Military Justice is a fair system. And so, for example, if Private or Sergeant Bergdahl is determined, if there's probable cause to believe that he went AWOL or he deserted, he'll get a fair trial in the U.S. Army. And that's what should happen. He should not be judged by people in armchairs second-guessing the decision to bring about his return. We do not leave people in the captivity of our enemies.
So did the Obama administration do the right thing when it decided to exchange five men for the release of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl?
Yes, I believe they did for several reasons. First of all, as I've said, it is a first principle of soldiering. You're taught this in basic. You do not leave a comrade behind. We don't allow the Taliban to judge him by their standards. We bring him home and we judge him by ours. And so that's an overriding objective. It is common in wars. It's always been common to have prisoner of war exchanges. In this case, President Obama, I believe, would have been obligated and will be obligated to release all of the Afghan detainees sooner or later anyway when we draw down our forces in Afghanistan and that conflict ceases as an American conflict. We would have no further legal right to detain him. So he obtained the release of Sergeant Bergdahl in exchange for giving up something he would have been required to give up fairly soon anyway.
You've been in private practice with your brother for years.
I have.
I have three brothers, and we often engage in spirited discussions of political issues. Has your brother been supportive of your decision to go to Gitmo and represent men held there?
Yes, I would say my brother, Jim, has been. It has not been without cost to our law firm, financial cost, significant cost. And as any prudent businessman, as my brother is, he questions that cost sometimes. But I really have to believe he's proud of my work and is very supportive of our decision to become involved.
Is it possible to close Guantanamo?
Well, of course it's possible to close Guantanamo. I mean, it was arbitrarily opened by President Bush in 2002 because he believed erroneously that it was beyond the reach of U.S. law. If it had a purpose, it served its purpose. And so I think it is certainly possible to close Guantanamo. I think the real issue, though, is not closing Guantanamo. Guantanamo is simply the venue where we are holding people without charge for extraordinary periods of time. I think the real issue is, do we, as Americans, hold people without charge indefinitely? And I think that is an un-American activity to engage in, and I hope that we not only close Guantanamo, but we cease holding these people without charge. You either try them or you release them.
Frank Goldsmith is a civil rights attorney, mediator, and Army veteran. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.